Hi, I'm Thelonious Gertz.
And I'm Rhea John, and this is Daily Discoveries, the weekly roundup of stories from the science section.
Okay, so today we're doing a little roundup of the stories that we've covered in the last couple weeks. We had a small hiatus due to some issues with the ducting in the communications building, but we are back and recording now. So we have three stories that we're going to talk to you about. We have one about the UW's quantitative science minor program, which is really cool. We have one on earthquakes, and then we have one on an HIV article that you actually wrote. So which one do you want to start with first?
Let's start with the earthquakes one.
Okay. Take it away.
Well, the earthquakes one was talking about the earthquake that just came to Washington State. So it was a 4.6, and it was just sort of about, I guess people kind of think of Washington as an unusual place for earthquakes, even though we're actually like quite at a high risk for getting earthquakes. We kind of associate that with more with California, and how this earthquake is kind of shallow, but we're kind of expecting or predicted to have a much larger earthquake sometime in the future, which is what we should be concerned about.
Yeah, and when Rachel was writing this article, another thing that was really interesting when she did her research is that the earthquake was not so much like a crazy, like, you know, destroy buildings earthquake. If you didn't live in like the Everett or Bothell areas, you really didn't feel it. But it is a good wake-up call for, you know, building better structures and creating more, you know, awareness around the damage that earthquakes have the potential to do. There's always like the talk of the big one, and, you know, I don't know how, you know, reliable people saying like, oh, well, if it hasn't happened yet, it's going to eventually, like, obviously, but like, we really don't have any idea when that's going to happen. But I think in the kind of shorter term, some other like geologic effects from earthquakes, it's really good to have this as kind of an account to work from.
Yeah, I think the like the concern definitely should shift from, oh, it's going to happen, to more like, because of our location, like there's definitely a risk. We haven't seen it yet. We may see it soon. And I think it's an interesting time for people to definitely think about their earthquake preparedness. And if the big one were to happen, you know, would you or your family or your loved ones be ready to kind of manage that in a way that keeps you safe, keeps you out of harm's way, and keeps you healthy if you need it?
Yeah, definitely. And another thing is, like, there's a lot of construction going on around UW right now, you know, present construction as well, that are going to be, you know, earthquake proof and or, you know, retrofitting old buildings. So it does like make me feel better that, you know, at least at UW, where we have a lot of old and kind of more rundown buildings, that there is stuff going on. But it also comes from having a really big budget and a lot of money to allocate to do that, whereas a lot of people who live in older homes or who work in older buildings where they don't have that kind of funding, you know, obviously there's a huge gap there. So that's like a big problem, obviously.
I would definitely be interested in learning more too about like across the area, what like portions of the city are best equipped right now. Is that just the areas with older buildings, or are there specific areas where like we should be putting more money and effort into safety precautions to keep those buildings from tumbling down eventually?
Yeah, definitely. And so, like, what did the scientists at UW say about this? I know Rachel interviewed one of them.
Well, they were mostly talking about, like, taking this as, like, a wake-up call to reinvest and refocus and really think about how would we handle this if it becomes a larger issue in the future. Just wondering, do you have, like, an earthquake preparedness plan, or does your family have one?
Oh, no. I'm on the extreme end of, like, not subscribing to any, like, doomsday or earthquake preparedness. Like, I know that people do. Like, there's a show on, it's on, like, some reality TV network, like, one of the cable ones. I think it's like Spike or like maybe the History Channel, I'm not sure, but there's a show called Doomsday Preppers where people spend exorbitant amounts of money like prepping for like their, you know, envisioned earthquake scenario. And this can be anything from dirty bomb attacks to like a, you know, the power grid being taken out to like bombings or whatever, and also like the big one, the big earthquakes. But like that, the people prepare on this show and they spend so much money and so much of their life in fear, where I'm like, why would you do that? Like, it seems like so much stress. And so I really haven't prepared anything. Like, I think I have some water in the back of my car, but like, I don't have any sort of like bunker or anything. Yeah. I don't know. I'm kind of like, just like, if it's gonna happen, it's gonna happen.
I think there's a kind of a middle ground in between like the extreme of doomsday preppers and maybe between the extreme of just letting it happen.
I'm too busy to plan all that right now.
Yeah. there's this actually this interesting article that was kind of related to this that I was reading, which I thought was so fun. It was about, they had kind of interviewed some UW professors on, like, what are your earthquake preparedness plans? They were kind of talking about what I thought was actually really interesting, sound advice that I never really heard before, because I've never really heard about personal earthquake preparedness beyond, like, you know, like those drills that you do in, like, elementary school where you get under the table and you wait.
But they stand in the doorway.
And they were talking about, like, keeping fuel so that they can, like, have things to cook with and, like, having some body of water that they know that they could, like, distill and use as drinking water if the time were to come to it, or, like, having emergency cash just in case, like, something were to happen and they'd have to leave their homes. And it was interesting to see that, you know, it's interesting what you can do to help yourself. And
And, I mean, there's people that go to the even farther extreme of, like, doing training procedures or, like, reenactment or, like, I guess pre-enactments of what, like, that, you know, situation could be like, where they, like, you know, get in the car and, like, they're, like heavily armed, and I don't know. Like, I think that soils some of it. But, yeah, no, earthquakes are a real deal, and, you know, we just need to continually be referencing scientific studies and the literature on that. So, yeah, so let's move on to talk about the quantitative science minor, a comparatively less, you know, stressful and exciting situation, but it's cool nonetheless. So basically, one of our writers wrote about the quantitative science minor, and basically, it's a minor and also a PhD program. Interestingly enough, there's no major, but there is a bunch of courses that are offered kind of through joint departments under the QSci name, and they come from fisheries, oceanography, and the College of the Environment. The minor, like, you know, lab, like, teaching area or whatever is in the oceanography teaching building. And what I did not know about this is that it's actually really interdisciplinary and really relevant for a lot of people's career development and for people that are going into, like, anything related to the environment, whether you be in, like, computer science and you want to do, like, biocomputational studies or research, or if you're in, you know, environmental studies or oceanography or any of these kind of more very natural science majors, the quantitative science minor provides an advanced set of mathematical and statistical skills that tackle a bunch of critical issues. Like, for example, talking about, like, how to, you know, analyze how populations of salmon or other fish change throughout the year. One of the people who was interviewed said that they had gotten a job directly out of college working for an environmental agency, and that their skills in the quantitative science minor really helped. And so I was kind of stunned by that, because when I was reading about it on the website, it's really not advertised that well. Like, they talk about, like, oh, you can, like, you know, learn how to do quantitative science, which I thought was just kind of like a statistics or math alternative. But it actually, you know, tackles a lot of really interesting problems within its curriculum, and it makes a point of engaging students with how to think critically about data, how to answer the questions that they want to answer. You know, it provides for any major, whether you be, you know, in environmental work or sciences or just in humanities, it provides them with analytical skill set, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. You know, I think that really, even as an, if you're not taking the whole minor, I think even as an elective, it sounds like just about anyone could benefit from taking a quantitative science class and, like, dipping their toe in and seeing what that's about. Because, you know, especially in the world today, we increasingly just, like, collect so much data about so many things. There's so much stuff out there, almost, like, almost more data than we really know what to do with, it seems sometimes, unless, of course, you're someone with the skills to, like, figure out from that data what is something important that you can understand and see about the world to solve problems. And sometimes, you know, just, like, the ability to sift through that and understand things better is so valuable. So I think it's, like, I think it's a really critical skill that a lot of people could benefit from learning.
Yeah, and from what I understand is, like, compared to math or statistics, which focuses on the methodology specifically, it is really interdisciplinary, and it covers fields like economics and psychology and other, you know, kind of emerging problems in everyday life, and it seeks to use these concepts to kind of underscore how important those projects are, but also provide people with a way to solve them. And so, like, the interdisciplinary nature really appeals to me, and I think, like, if they advertise it better, or if they, you know, talk about student stories more, more people would probably know about it. So So yeah, that there's not really a lot to say. I would just say read the article. It's really interesting. Like, all of the student stories were just fascinating because I had never, you know, considered them that much. But yeah. So do you want to talk about your HIV article?
Yeah, I would really love to. So the HIV article was talking about this. It's basically this vaccine trial that's being put on, and it's being put on by the HIV Vaccine Trial Network. So and it's in partnership with Fred Hutch. It's in partnership with Johnson & Johnson, as well as a lot of other groups as well. And it's this really cool, like, public-private partnership that's allowing them to have the money and the funding, and it's global. So the idea is that they, what they were kind of telling me is that, so when it comes to HIV, there's a lot of strains of HIV around the world, or a lot of types, clades is what they called it. So maybe we develop an HIV vaccine that works in one part of the world, and then when you go to another part of the world and try that same vaccine out, since you based it on, you know, a clade that exists in one place, it might not be as effective for those people who are there. And it's really important to get to a place where you can treat a lot of different people with one thing and have it be really effective. So this vaccine combines information from known strains of the virus. I think it's more than 90% of them. So it combines it, so it's effective. It's meant to be effective in a lot of different people in a lot of different regions, which is why this trial is global. So across the world, people will be taking this, like, two-step injection, and they'll be monitored over the course of a year, and they'll keep receiving this injection, I believe, at three-month periods.
Yeah.
So every 3 months, they get the injection, they keep living their lives, and they'll be monitored to see, you know, their immune activity and whether this is effective. And they're hoping that it reaches, it ends up being like 65% effective is like their benchmark goal right now. Obviously more than that would be incredible and wonderful, but even less than that would be terrific, because what she was kind of telling me is that in a lot of places where HIV is really prevalent, and for a lot of the communities that they're working with, even, I guess, their data and their models have shown that even a partially effective vaccine would be really helpful, and then they can look into improving it further.
Yeah, and so in the article, it talks about how geography was a barrier. And so by geography, I just want to specifically clarify. So, like, in different regions where they're maybe separated by, you know, some, like, great distance or obstacle, different strains of the HIV vaccine can manifest or, like, you know, adapt to those populations?
Not exactly. It's more like, you know, like, geography is a barrier in terms of, if, say, you develop your vaccine in North America, well, then if you transport that to, like, say, like, Southeast Africa, then suddenly, you know, you might not be as effective at treating HIV there because it's developed in a different part of the world, and it might have different characteristics that make it resistant to the vaccine you're trying to treat it with.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I think that this is really exciting because, you know, HIV has been, HIV is such a, such a life-altering issue for a lot of people, and there are a lot of ways to manage it, but not everyone has access to those ways of managing it. Like, I was taking this class where we were talking about, the whole class was sort of dissecting in low and middle income countries what health infrastructure is like, and we worked a lot on, like, what prevents people from seeing, you know, the preventive measures that we've developed for HIV. Sometimes it's social, sometimes it's infrastructural, but a lot of times it's also, like, cost and, like, repetitive use. One of the most effective methods for preventing HIV right now is, like, taking PrEP if you're if you're, like, at risk, if you're an at-risk population. But PrEP can also be very expensive. It's really hard to implement, and you have to take it every single day for it to be effective. And with a vaccine, whether you're taking it one time or even if you're coming in, like, once every 3 months, it's a lot more likely, in my opinion, that you're actually going to be able to receive that treatment and you're actually going to be able to benefit from it.
Yeah, and so according to, like, PrEP, what are the at-risk populations, or, like, what does, like, that generally look like?
What's considered an at-risk population in general, and also by this study, it's generally men who have sex with men, and then transgender individuals. That's what this study is focusing on specifically. On a larger scale, like, according to the WHO, what's considered at-risk, I think, includes also, like, sex workers and other groups of people who might be vulnerable in that way.
Yeah, and I think it's also really good that they're putting more investment into talking about HIV in these communities, because often these communities are the ones that, like, you know, the mainstream public is like, oh, you know, we're just not going to even talk about those because they've faced so much stigma and so much discrimination that you just don't even start to address these issues. But, like, if you did actually, you know, put that aside and spend the time and actually realize that all of that stuff was, like, totally bogus, then you know, would be able to prevent a huge systemic barrier and, like, alter a lot of these you know, complications with HIV that are like very segregated in the groups that they do affect. Yeah, so
definitely.
I think this is a really cool article, and I was really excited to, you know, get it out there. And it's mm-hmm. a really big one too. Like, you know,
yeah.
it's more of a wide ranging and kind of global study, which mm-hmm. I think, you know, at least I haven't seen in the literature that I have read. So
I think what's really exciting about it too is that, you know, just the study being funded and starting itself is such a huge leap. It's something so exciting to mm-hmm. learn about. But also, as they're monitoring this and as results are coming out and as they learn more about how effective and how safe this vaccine is, we have so many more results to look forward to mm-hmm. when it comes to how this actually helps the populations it's being administered to.
And based on, like, the study duration, how long will it take before they have real-world results to work off of?
Well, it looks like they're going to start by, I know that they're going to start by monitoring them for up to 30 months, but it's like 3 month intervals for a year that they're being treated.
Yeah.
So I believe after that, they're going to continue for another 1 or 2 years as well.
Wow. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's going to be a while.
Yeah. Yeah. But science is like that, right? Nothing ever happens yeah. immediately. It takes so much time and repetition for it to come about.
Yeah. But at least someone's doing something about that. Mm-hmm. So that's really good.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. So do you have anything else to add about that article or any of the others?
I think what I have to add about this article, I guess, as a conclusion, is that sometimes it kind of gets lost that, you know, when we develop solutions for a problem, and then, at least in my mind, before I kind of, like, you know, in college and would get into this stuff, I was very confused about how, like, you know, we develop the solution from a problem, and then, like, why isn't that problem just solved for everyone all the time? And sometimes it gets lost that there's so many things that can form a barrier between an individual and the treatment they need, whether that's their culture, their society, the fact they just don't have a road to, like, use to get to the treatment they want, or, like, the lack of people to actually administer treatment to them. And by changing the ways in which we present a solution, we can really help a lot more people. So
yeah.
I think that's really exciting.
Definitely. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening today, and please tune in next week. We'll have more science content and more stuff to chat about. Without further ado, have a great week.